Hey there, welcome to this weekend interview on the Inside Running Podcast. This weekend I chatted with Callum Elson, UK runner, represented GB recently at the World Indoor Champs and the World Cross Country Championships last year in Bathurst. Won't talk about him too much, his bio, because I go through all that in the introduction. Really good chat. I reckon if you've got this plugged in for a long run, the first hour, 70 minutes, is going to go pretty quick because he is very, very good on the microphone. Good guy to have a conversation with. And yeah, I found him super fun to talk to. Really engaging. And yeah, the time went super fast when I was having a chat with him. He's got some great views on the sport, good energy. Yeah, just the perfect guest really to interview. And it makes it very, very easy on my side of the mic when you're interviewing a guy of Callum's caliber. So I hope you enjoy this one. Hopefully it gets you through some kind of run. And yeah, we really appreciate your support and the fact that you're picking our podcast to listen to over the weekend. Cheers, guys. Enjoy this chat with Callum Elson. All right, this weekend's guest on the Inside Running Podcast is a silver medalist at last year's World Road Running Championships in the mile. He has some quick times over the shorter distances, dabbles a bit in cross country, and represented GB at the recent World Indoor Championships and the World Cross Country Championships in Bathurst, Australia in 2023. He is a man who isn't afraid to share an opinion on the sport. Welcome to the Inside Running Podcast, Callum Elson.
How you doing, mate? Thanks for having me. An honour. I'm finally made it up to the top level of the podcasting game.
And I wouldn't say that. We're very grateful you've given us an hour of your time. So it's pretty rare we have global medalists on our show. We had Bernard Lagat comes to mind, but I can't think of too many other global medalists we've had on the show. So it's an honour for us.
Yeah, Lagat's definitely got a few more legitimate medals than me. I would say mine's kind of clutching at straws with the World Road Champs, but you got to be in it to win it, and you know, no one can take that from me now, so there you go.
Yeah, I do have a note down here, like you seem to be a guy who over the last couple of years has really made the most of every opportunity. Like you first come onto my radar when you, I was looking back at some of the messages we'd sent to each other, when you did come to Bathurst for that World Mixed relay team, and it just feels like over the last couple of years you've just jumped at everything, and your trajectory, I know you're injured at the moment, but was heading in a pretty positive direction.
Yeah, I think too many times people can be too professional with things where you think there's a set way that needs to be done. Like you look at the very top level, so in Britain we'd look at a Josh Kerr, a Whiteman, whoever, and you think, oh well, they avoid indoors because they're getting ready for outdoors, or they don't do this cross country, or you can overthink it. When you're an up and coming athlete, there's nothing better than one, getting the experience, and two, getting the exposure of regularly getting your name out there, people being like, oh, he's on this team and he's doing that, and then everything snowballs from there. And to be honest, I knew that's what I needed to get support from brands and stuff like that. I need to show like some legitimacy of being like, okay, I've represented Great Britain on a number of occasions. I am actually pretty good, you know? So that's how you can start the conversation. So I was like, look, if no one wants to do a mixed relay because they think it's crap, fine, I'll do it. Like, I don't mind. If no one wants to do like this World Road Champs because they don't know what it is, great. Like, less people for me to compete against to make the team. And it's paid off in the end. So obviously, hindsight is 2020. It could have been terrible, you know, but it's worked out in the end.
Yeah, good. I will ask, we'll go through your PBs in a second because that's what we traditionally do on this show, but thoughts of the World Cross Country Champs in Bathurst, what were your impressions of Australia? Kind of outback, well, not quite outback, but pretty regional spot to be sent. I'm not sure if you'd been to Australia before, but yeah, pretty much around 50% of our listeners are Australians, so be careful with some of your comments there.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I'm good friends with Adam Fogg, and obviously Adam was in Australia for a while. And when I got picked for the team, he's like, I'm so sorry that this is your first time in Australia and that's all you get to see of it. And I was like, that's like probably a nice way of putting it, where it was like a fantastic event, amazing. And I think the fact that it gets spread around the world is important rather than just having it in, you know, really traditional places or major cities. Thought the crowd was good. The course was obviously kind of like had some, I don't know if you want to call it prestige, but like it obviously had the car racing tie and that sort of thing. So I think the event was amazing. Obviously for us, it was a long way to travel in terms of the logistics of getting there, not necessarily optimal for performance, but you know, it's not the end of the world. If I could change anything, it would have been, like I said, to travel more around. Like we flew to Sydney and then we were there for 12 hours overnight and then we had to, you know, move on to the next place. Whereas if we could have gone 3-4 days earlier, seen a few other places and stuff like that. So I can say I've been to Australia, but haven't seen much of it. Not really. I've seen the inside of a hotel room and I've seen a cross-country course.
Did they fly you from Sydney to Bathurst or did you drive it?
Yeah, we flew, okay. Yeah. So that was like pretty quick. I think it was like half an hour.
Gee, that would have been a small plane, wouldn't it?
Yeah, really small, yeah. You know when the pilot's like, you can't take your backpack on there, lads. You're just going to chuck it in the back. That's right. I was like, all right, this is going to be a fun flight.
Yeah, that's a good experience. I think I heard a whisper as well. You had a pretty good night on the beers after the race. A couple of my teammates from my local running club, I told them I'd heard of you and was listening to a podcast and stuff you were on. And then they were like, when you won that world silver medal, they're like, this is the guy from the urinal at the pub at Bathurst who was pretty hammered. And then they didn't think much of you at the time. And then when they saw that result, they're like, shit, that was that guy.
That's quality. That is quality. I love that. No, it has to be fair. Joe Wigfield, who's another British athlete, was on the team with me. And we were kind of like, we come all the way to Australia. We're going to have a good time here. And going through my camera roll, it's funny to see some of the stuff I've got of unnamed professional athletes out there having arm wrestles or down in beers or whatever. So no, I love that side of it. And to be honest, we always joke about having an idea where we should have like a Patreon where we, for every race video you make, there should be like a uncensored version that comes out on Patreon where it's like the night out after the race. Cause actually that's where like all the memories from the sport, you see the other side of the athletes. Like, I think I love that side of it. And yeah, Riga was the exact same for the World Road Running Champs. There's a few Aussies there and yeah, everyone likes to have a good laugh.
Yeah, I think UK and Australians obviously get along pretty well. Yeah, pretty similar personalities, but we will go through your PBs. Feel free to jump in any time to tell us any significant stories about when you hit these ones and what kind of memories they bring. So the 800 metres, 149. Any fond memories experiences?
not a fond memory. I was in we have something called the British Milers Club here, like, you know, regional races. I was in the C race. I'd run like 3:36 or 3:38 at this point, but my 800 PB was so slow because I've not really done any of that. I was ranked so low. I was in the C race, so I think I came second. I say it's a bit windy, but I'm sure everyone says their PBs were windy up here, so that's like a thing you got to say. I don't hate the 800, but like I struggle so much with it. It's so second nature to me to run the first lap of the race faster than any other lap you're going to run. You know, like I'm so much more of a strength-based athlete that the 8 just, yeah, I need to get over the mental barrier and just absolutely hammer it, but it's easier said than done.
What have you clocked for a 400? I'm pretty sure there wasn't anything on the World Athletics profile today, but I didn't actually look, to be honest.
No, I've definitely never done an official 4. I honestly, my fastest 4 is probably the first lap of an 8.
Yeah.
I've probably gone through in, I don't know, like 51 something or 52 or something like that is probably the fastest. I think I could probably sneak under 50, but I've not got insane wheels. I can kick off a fast pace, which is obviously important for the 1500. But yeah, in an out and out sprint, I think I'd be left for dead by most 8:15 runners.
Yeah. So the 1500, 3:35, which is pretty recent.
Yeah, that was good. That was the end of the summer. That was in the UK, actually. But a really international field got pulled together randomly like 2 days after the London Diamond League. I think Sam Tanner was around and wanted to get in some kind of, he wanted to practice the rounds basically for World Champs. So he'd had London Diamond League on the Sunday, I think it was. This was either a Tuesday or a Wednesday. And then we had quite a lot of Aussies were in that race as well that were over in London at the time at Tooting Beck. And yeah, that got won. I think Sam ran 3:34. High or 3:35 low. I was there with 3:35 in second. And yeah, a lot of the athletes from that race have gone on this indoors to run seriously quick. Adam Fogg was in there, obviously ran for some 3:50. One of his Under Armour teammates was in there. John, I think he ended up running 3:51 mile indoors. So it was kind of a bit of a who's who's race, actually. I don't think it ever was going to be slow just because of the names in there. You know, if you're a 3:30 runner, Santana, you're not going to leave it up to chance to get beaten by some like idiots that are at the local track. You're going to make sure you go out hard.
And a bit of like end of season vibes with a bit of nothing to lose, like just roll the dice a bit for pacing kind of thing for you guys?
Kind of, yeah. I got quicker every race pretty much. Like I started the season pretty badly, but I've learned it just takes me a few races to get going. And then probably, excluding the championship races, probably 6 1500s in a row, I'd just gone like 3:40, 3:39, 3:38, 3:36. Like I was on a bit of a roll. So I was kind of like, well, if I've run 3:36, the next thing to go for, there's no point going out slower than that pace. So yeah, I think I don't know what the pace was set for, and Nick Bedeau was there with some athletes. I think he organised all that sort of thing. So yeah, I just jumped on it, and luckily, I say luckily, like I think that's what I deserved that season. I don't know if any quicker was necessarily. I think I really reached my potential for that summer of where I was at. I don't think there was. I didn't leave the summer thinking, oh, maybe I could have run a 34 or a 33. I was like, actually, that's a fair reflection, I think, of where I currently am.
Yeah. And what do you put that down to? Like the PB nearly pretty much every race, like was it you growing in confidence and feeling more comfortable, or were you seeing things in your fitness during training that you're like, I'm actually progressing my fitness as the season goes?
Yeah, a mixture of a few things. I think one undeniable thing is just getting into better races. Like if I think about each PB I got, I wasn't winning any of these races. I was still coming third, fourth. You know, my best finish was probably a second. So the fields I was getting into were of athletes that, okay, even if I beat them in the last 100, I've been towed around for 1400 by people that are really going for it and know that they're capable of running those times. So that's like something that you can't hide away from. The quicker my PB got, the more race directors would let me into a better race, and therefore it just kept snowballing. The other thing is, I think races for me is what gets me into shape more than training. I'm really good at doing all the base work, all that sort of thing. But honestly, my first races of the season are just pretty crap relative to where I end up at the end of the season. Whether it's like, you know, people say, don't they, like Rust Buster or this or that. To be honest, I think for me, it's just like I can't really simulate in training that same like lactic feeling. And on the third lap, just wanting to step off and having to just like keep pushing basically. So it takes me 3 or 4 races to get going. So I think the second half of the season, I'm always a little bit stronger anyway.
Yeah. The mile, so 3:53 on the track and then 3:56 on the road, which was a silver medal at the World Champs. Got those ones correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the 3:53 is Boston. So like, and take that from what you will, you know, like, I feel like if you run slow at Boston, you're not going to run fast anywhere. And that again was exactly how I described with the 15. It was like the last weekend to get the qualifying for World Indoors. So everyone in the race, whatever country they're from, was pretty much like, I have to run under 3:53.5. So I'm going to go for it. And I just snuck under it. So that was good. I think that's probably the equivalent of say like 3:36-ish. So like, that's why it's kind of frustrating that I've got injured, because indoors I've got close to my outdoor PB. And then, you know, so obviously everyone says, oh, what could have been, but it looks like I could have been on for a good summer. And then the road one, yeah, that's, I actually don't know how I ran 3:56. I think it was a good course. And I was just protected by a pack of like, unlike the track where at most you're in single file, if not kind of like two abreast, here it was like 6 guys on the front row and I was maybe 3 rows back. So I got carried like so far until it just opened up. And then obviously pushed onto the front a little bit. So yeah, I think I'd struggle to find a road mile with such a good course, didn't have many corners, was slightly, it was obviously flat overall, but like the way that the undulation worked meant that it was quite undulating in the first half, and then you could just roll for the second half. And I had a group of, I don't know, 12, 14 people in front of me that carried me. So that again was a pretty nice way to run a 3:56.
Yeah, and you're bloody close to winning a world championship. So like, it brings probably the best out of you.
Yeah, definitely. I couldn't believe it, honestly. That's like, that genuinely was like I can't really remember what I think in races a lot of the time. And like afterwards, I'm just like, oh, it's gone in a blur. But I have this really distinct memory of the road opening up slightly. I don't know how long was left, maybe 200, 300. And I consciously thought in my head, I'm about to win. Like I just thought, shit, I'm actually going to win this. Like, this is unreal. And then obviously I came second. But it's not often, especially on the track, because you know exactly where you are on the track. You can kind of calculate things like, okay, last 200, I can see the clock is this time, or I might run a 28, so I'm roughly on for this. And it can, if you're off pace, it can be quite demoralizing. But with the road, because the time is completely irrelevant and it's just a race, I had no idea how long was left. I could see a finish line in the distance and you just kind of going crazy and hoping that you get there in time. So it was such a good weekend. Like it helped me break through and now have a contract and do other stuff. So I look on it with a lot of fond memories. It was really good.
Yeah. And at the time, like, because Hobbs Kessler, he won, and didn't it, because it's a new event, that was the world record, his winning time. So was yours like a British record? Have I got that right?
Well, so I mean, Wikipedia is not the best source, is it? But technically I've got the British record, and I think technically I've got the European record, but I don't think they get officially ratified. So I don't think, like, I mean, What's the way of describing it? I'm pretty sure there's certain protocol, isn't there, for a world record? You've got to have drug testing, you've got to have X, Y, and Z. Obviously, that was all set up in order for it to be a world record. But whether those applied on the same as a British record and a European record, I don't know. But yeah, all I can think about that is Hobbs got, what, 50 grand?
Yeah.
Got $50,000
as well
for the world record. And he finished like 0.2 ahead of me or something like that. So that's going to, you know, I mean, I got a bit of prize money for second, but I can tell you it wasn't 50 grand. So that's going to pain me for the rest of my life.
Off that result, though, so that, like, going off him claiming the world record that day, you were the second fastest of all time for the road mile.
Yeah, and I think I'm like, technically speaking, again, based on the times that have been run, I know there was one in Hawaii that was reasonably quick, but the winner only did 3:57. Vinciati won that. I've been keeping an eye on my road miles since this, basically. And then there was the one at Adidas the other day in Germany where they did that around the Adidas HQ. And the guy obviously broke the world record and Hobbs came in second anyway. So I think technically I'm still third or fourth, maybe fastest road mile, but I don't know if I can go around claiming that, honestly.
Do you, when you introduce your people who don't know a lot about running, do you lead with, like, I'm the world silver medalist?
To be honest, only in written formats. Like, if I have to introduce myself to, like, a brand on an email or, like, some sort of bio, I feel way more comfortable putting it as, like, a little achievement. I feel like it's more acceptable. When I just meet people, I'm rubbish. Like, my girlfriend actually gets quite wound up at how little I explain about what I actually do, because I'm just like, oh, yeah, I just, like, work for myself at home and, like, yeah, I do running. And she has to butt in and be like, no, he actually does running. Like, yeah, it's what his job is. Because it just feels like it's not very a sexy sport. It's not like, oh, yeah, I've got training tomorrow with Man United, like, I'm playing football with the lads or whatever. It's like, oh, I'm going out running tomorrow because I've got a race in 6 months' time. It's just, I think people don't really understand that it can be like an actual job. I feel like I'm a little bit unemployed in that sense.
Yeah, and we might get there a bit later on as well, but are you guys experiencing the running boom in the UK at the moment? Like, so, like, it's going nuts here in Australia and actually trying to, like, I'm a school teacher and I'll, you know, I work at a pretty big school. So people will get into running and I don't really know them that well. And we'll have conversations about running and it's you don't want to try to present that you know what you're talking about and you take the shit serious. But at the same time, it's like you want them to enjoy the sport. So it's a weird, I don't know, I find this battle at the moment between influencers and people who have been in the sport for 20 years. And, you know, you hear these terms like gatekeepers to the sport and real runners and all these kind of bullshit things. Like, it's, I feel like people have kind of lost their place or just don't know what position they're in at the moment with describing themselves as a runner.
Yeah, 100% agree. Everyone's a runner now. That's the thing. And like, depending on who you're speaking to, there's different gauges that people have, right, on like what's a runner. So to some people, it's like, oh, I've completed 25 marathons. So suddenly that gives them a credibility of like, wow, that's amazing. Now, they might have done 25 marathons. They might all be 5 hours and they've just like run walked them and like they've done them over a period of 20 years or whatever. Now, to me, if you say to me, oh, I've done two marathons and I ran 2:12 and 2:13, obviously I'm going to look at that person with a bit more credibility because of my understanding of the sport. But I think as more and more new people come into running, they either look at the person who runs the most miles that they know of is the best runner to them in the world, and therefore they should listen to them, or the person who is the fastest runner they know. And for most people, that's someone that maybe runs 17-minute, 18-minute park run. That's like, wow, that's like, God, that's the guy who wins every week at the park run or whatever. So I think those people, rightly or wrongly, start to understand they have a bit of a position of credibility, and they're like, wow, people actually listen to me here. Like, if I say wear these shoes, like, I've noticed people start buying them, and that turns into an Instagram page called, like, you know, Callum Does Running or whatever. And then you're like, all right, hang on a minute, now thousands of people online are like, if I say I won the park run and I wore the Saucony Triumph whatever, they're going to be like, oh, I'll get by that pair, and now they're giving me a discount code and I can make £10 every time I sell them. Oh, this is fantastic, let me make more reels about it. And then you can just see how it kind of unfolds that way. And I, good on anyone that does running. Like, I think if you're going out and you're doing it, fantastic. I just think understand whether you're best placed to potentially give advice on it. You know, I went to school. Does that mean that I'm good at giving advice on the education system? Probably not. Does someone who's worked as a teacher for 10 years, do they have, you know, better understanding than me? Definitely. You know, it's quite like logical. I feel like the same should be applied to running, but yeah, marketing doesn't exactly work that way.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people who want a bit of that pie that the running boom brings. But yeah, I totally agree. I think it's probably the most important thing is looking where you're getting your information from in the running space at the moment, because there's a lot of misleading stuff and there's a lot of great stuff out there as well. We're living in a world where some of the most accessible information is, yeah, so easy to access from people. I know when I got into running 20 years ago, like there was, you know, one Runner's World magazine. That's about it. They just pretty much copy and paste the shit from the US. Like, you didn't know anything about Australian distance runners. So,
yeah. I don't know if you guys are experiencing this, but are you noticing a lot of people making a transition from, like, I don't know, like run clubs or run groups, running crews, whatever you want to call them, into proper athletics clubs? That's the big thing I'm noticing right now, where a lot of people came into it from the Instagram, like social side, where they're like wearing a hydration vest for a 5K and like doing everything that they see online. But once they've been in it for, say, 6 months, 9 months, they've started to see something from Sweat Elite, see a podcast, see like a Canova thing, or like they start to gradually get information from, let's call it like real running or athletics, whatever you want to say. And then they start to realize they take it a bit more seriously and move away from that kind of misinformation, social media side of things, and maybe transition to leaving the social Thursday night pub group and they join like an athletics club where they're training twice a week and start to take it more seriously. So I think it is actually coming a bit more full circle where like people are, it is good, we're getting more people into the sport and they are actually transitioning into like the traditional athletics club system, which I don't think the older people, maybe like if you're 70 and you've been in the sport for a while and you just see people charging for coaching or doing whatever and you kind of hate on it, I think you need to also recognize that it is pushing more people into like the actual sport as well, which is good.
Yeah, we obviously see it with the fun runs over here and like our bigger marathons all selling out, but not so much like the state cross country, you know, 10 race tournament and stuff, or the milers kind of club stuff that you're talking about. Oh, actually, they've got pretty good numbers, but yeah, I'm not 100% sure if it's fully came back to that yet, but I feel like the tide's turning a bit where, because there's so much information accessible, people are starting to call out the bullshit information. Like, you're starting to get screenshots of people's Instagram comments where, you know, hotly debated topics are getting, you know, back and forth and a bit of lips getting thrown and stuff like that, which I think is probably good for the sport that, you know, some of this stuff's kind of getting called out.
Yeah, ChatGPT, that's the one. People write me an Instagram post of how to run a faster 5K and then copy and paste it with a reel of you, you know, jumping up and down outside a coffee shop. That's the formula right now to go viral.
Yeah, well, you've done pretty well on your online presence. We'll get to it later, but we still haven't got to your 3K. 802 for 3K back in 2022?
Yeah, I think that's probably my worst. No, I think that's my worst PB, I'd say. Well, obviously, my like half marathon stuff is terrible. But yeah, that if you look at my 15, it should be way quicker. I just haven't done one in ages. I think that's indoors 2021. And I think it was 2 days after. I think I doubled that weekend indoors. I think I'd already done a mile on maybe the Friday and that was the Sunday or something like that. So yeah, in an ideal world, that would be 7:40 something. But that's on me for not doing a 3K recently.
Yep. And then the 5K, 13:52.
Yeah, again, 2021. Progressed a lot since then, I think, a lot stronger. In an ideal world, that would be, I think if I'd done one last year, I could have definitely been 13:30s. The plan this year was like 13:20 summit, but anyone can say they're going to do it. Doing it's a different thing. But hopefully when I get back, the priority will be, rather than trying to rush back to the 15, it'll be working down the distances. So I'll definitely start with some fives and then move down as and when I can.
Yeah. And the 10, I found a 30:11.
Yeah, 30:11 on the track with old spikes. So what's that, like 27:11 or something like that?
Yeah, probably. I think I was about 30:05 in old spikes. So whatever, if you're applying those kind of takeoff times, I'll take it.
There you go. We're Olympians, yeah. Based on that. No, I can't remember exactly when that was. I think it was either just after. Have you got the year?
2021, I've got here, yeah.
Yeah, I think that must be during, I think it was like a post-COVID like type of race or something. I'm not 100% sure exactly what the setup was, but I did win, but I was in the B race of that. And again, that shows my like development as a runner. If you can see that these PBs for 5 and 10 are from 2021, that's because I was thought that's like what I was doing. And again, I was in a like a small bubble where I was very good for my recency to running at those distances, and there wasn't a lot of young people doing a 10k on the track. So you kind of like, oh, I'm first under 20 or whatever it was, under 23 in the UK, like this is great. And then when you learn more about running, you realize, well, actually that's because no one else is doing them, and there's actually 100 teenagers out there or whatever that could beat you at 10k. They're all just doing 800s and 15s because they're young. And then since then I've pivoted since I went to the States and done middle distance stuff. So yeah, those PBs eventually will get rewritten, but might be a while.
Yeah, well, you described yourself as a strength-based like athlete, and when we're talking about the 800s, but it feels like your race selection for strength-based events has been more towards like the cross country than it has to be like, let's jump on a quick 5K, or let's prioritize a quick 10K, even the half. Like, you'd run a pretty quick half off the training you do as well.
Yeah, I think so. It's, to be honest, it all comes back to the first thing you said about taking opportunities. Like, I've pretty much over the last couple of years developed my whole race schedule around what's best to qualify for things. So like, if I want to make the Euro cross team for Britain, I need to make sure I do some cross races. So when I'm deciding, is it better to do a 10K cross to prepare or do a fast road 10K and get a PB? I'm like, well, I'll just suck it up and do the cross because it's going to prepare me best for the trials. And then same where indoors, yeah, it would have been great to do a 3K, but based on the weekends I had, I was like, it's going to take me three or four shots to try and get the 1500 time. So like, I can't waste a weekend trying to get a 3K PB. I have to, you know, keep the ball rolling. And the same happens outdoors, albeit you have a bit more time to open up with a five or something like that. So in an ideal world, I would like to do stuff. And I think I've definitely got ability to shave a lot of PBs and have some good races. But just on the selection of qualifying times and when I want to try and get things and needing to take two or three races before I'm actually any good, it's just a need to select the shorter distances.
Have you got a favorite race distance to race?
I don't know. Like, I'm too emotional. I'm like, I don't look at things objectively. I'm so like, I always think of my best result or the one that I felt good in as like my favorite race. So I always say like, oh, 1500 a mile is great, but that's where I've seen the most success. So of course I'm going to say that that's the best one. I actually think that, I don't know, actually, like, I do think there's something special about cross country. I think the cross country is a long enough distance that you and not going at a pace where your brain just switches off. You actually think about what you're doing. You think about the tactics. You think about whether you should go faster than someone on the hill or save yourself for the downhill. Or I think there's actually more to it. So you feel like you're in the race more, which I enjoy. So I actually do think I really enjoy cross, albeit it's not necessarily my best event.
Well, you almost got to think about every single step, don't you? Like, where's that foot getting placed so you can actually keep the rhythm going?
Yeah, which is very true. And I think that's where you see some athletes like the physical versus mental side. I think, again, it's similar in the road mile where the best 1500 meter athletes in the world are not the best at a road mile or a cross country mile or whatever, because it's not a case of just getting your head down for four laps on a track, following a straight line and just like hammering it, which is pretty much all physical. There's no mental side of really time trialing other than needing to push yourself. Whereas as soon as you've got twists, corners, you know, drafting in the wind, all these things that come up in crossing a mile, it's far more about like outwitting an opponent, tactics of a race, that sort of thing. And I think that's where I've had a bit more success on that side, because I'm physically inferior at the moment to what my kind of running brain is. I think I need to keep training for a few years, get a lot stronger and stuff in order for my physical side to get up and match where other people are at. But I think I can kind of balance out a little bit by maybe racing a bit smarter, which is, you know, a bonus, but obviously not ideal because you're still going to get outkicked by people, etc.
Yeah, you got to have both, don't you? Is it safe to say, like, recently signed with Hoka as well, so like your first, I know you've done some stuff with Saw in the past, some quality kit from those guys. They sponsored the show real early days and I love the stuff they sent us at the time. But like, is it safe to say you've come out of that kind of hustle stage of your running career where you had to take every opportunity and work super hard and, you know, you need every weekend to try hit a qualifying time, and now, you know, after this injury, which we'll talk about in a second, like, yeah, it should be a bit smoother for you?
100%. Yeah, 100%. I think in a way the, like, that hustle time, if you will, actually helped me a lot, because you don't have time to think, is that on to the next thing? You're always looking forward, you're not looking back. And even if something doesn't go well, you're not dwelling on that you didn't qualify for this or you didn't do that, because there's already something coming up straight away. And I mean, I was looking at the schedule for next year, and I think we have like, the, you know, there's like Euro indoors, World Outdoors, World Road. Well, there's like a million chances to qualify and do things. And the former version of myself might have gone, right, I'm going to try and qualify for all five. Like, I need all the maximum opportunities. Whereas next year, having the security of, okay, I've got a brand that supports me, there's not a massive weight of expectation to have to go out and do this or run this time, I can think about what's the best for my development and maybe pick out, okay, in an ideal world, we'll try and go to this championship, but only if we can take these necessary steps to get there. And there's not a, I don't have a pressure to have to try and make a team to get my name out there to build exposure. I've kind of put in that legwork, got, touch wood, luckily, like a good reward for it, where a brand's gone, right, for this amount of years, we're going to support you. And like, we believe in trying to get you to a next Olympics or whatever it is, which should now allow me and my coach especially to kind of, you know, be a bit more sensible, because often I'm driving us away from what's physiologically best for me by saying, well, actually, no, I need to get ready for this in 5 weeks, or I need a shot at this. And he's like, well, in an ideal world, we'll have a week off here and then we'll build to this. And, you know, you might need another 6 weeks after that to actually be where we want you. We've not had that luxury, or I've not felt we've had that luxury. Yeah. So it'll be great now going forward.
Like altitude camps, you know, all those kind of things. Like, here's a race in two months' time. Like, the racing block starts in 2 months' time and you start hitting everything from there.
Yeah, and I'm like terrible at that sort of thing. It's like, how can I get to my level when I'm running 335 and I've like still not really been to altitude? I've been to Potchefstroom in South Africa, which is, you know, it's basically just warm. You know, it's a little bit higher. But like, in my head, I should be setting aside time where I'm like away for 8 weeks doing this. But the attitude I've had, and I'm glorifying it as if it's the right thing. It probably isn't in the long term the right thing to do, albeit it has paid off for me. It's like, well, when people are away and they're not racing because they're in Font Romeu or they're in Flagstaff and they're doing this, they're missing this race or this trial that gets them here. Or actually, well, those five guys are gone. So I've gone from being maybe the sixth best in the race to now I'm winning the race. And off the back of it, I've got five magazine articles. And now Hoka are thinking, oh, this guy's getting a bit of noise. Maybe we'll start a conversation with him. So it, again, hindsight's 2020. It's worked out for me. But for all I know, if I'd changed the strategy last year, maybe gone away on camps, been a bit more reserved with things, who knows, maybe that 335 race does become a 333. So, you know, there's no right way of doing it, I don't think.
Yeah, and recently represented GB at the World Indoor Champs, which you got spiked. And we've all been spiked in track and field races before, but you got a partially torn Achilles because the guy pretty much stood on your Achilles and, I don't know, sliced it? Is that a good way, like, yeah, a freak accident?
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, like you said, you get spiked all the time. And I always finish and I've got like a wound or whatever. And I'm like, oh, war wound, like make a joke out of it. But yeah, this one, I mean, I don't know how the odds of it would work, but the millimeters of like precision that it's happened with, I'm sure it's like pretty hard to replicate again. Because as my back leg from my swing is coming down, his front leg's coming forward, and it must have just caught at a very slight angle and almost like perfect pendulum timing that his spike has, all of his spikes to be fair, but one of them in particular is, yeah, cut into my Achilles, which it obviously hasn't gone, it's not gone like straight through the tendon, like with that individual spike. The spike has nicked into the tendon. So obviously it's caused like a weakness. And then as I've taken more steps afterwards, thinking like, what the hell's just happened? And I go to grab my calf, that's where the tendon has kind of come apart from itself because it's obviously been so weak from getting the spike into it. But yeah, frustrating. Just an annoying injury. Like, it's good that I didn't cause it. I didn't overtrain. I didn't go into it thinking I've got a bit of a niggle, and I didn't have like a dilemma of should I, shouldn't I race, which I think would be harder to deal with. But it's just frustrating knowing like the trajectory we talked about, and then an accident like that can happen. But at least I went down in a blaze of glory. It wasn't like a, you know, I fell over at training or something like that. Yeah, at least it was
represent
there for
your country at a world championship. Yeah. A decent place to go down. And the like the event you're trying to qualify for, like moving forward, looking ahead to the next few years, like you guys have got the two previous world champions who were wearing the same singlet you're trying to wear. Like, that excite you, scare you, motivate you when you're kind of throwing around some of the names you're up against at the moment trying to, yeah, get a singlet from?
Yeah, it's difficult. I think it's good for British athletes in general, because even though it's harder to make teams, the country and athletics especially just got way more eyeballs on it. So from like, you know, whatever that quote is, rising tide, all the ships going up, all that sort of stuff. Yep. It's like, it's good from that perspective. And I think also people have broken through all in slightly different ways. So you've obviously had like Kerr's gone through the NCAA, gone that way. You've had Whiteman, who's like made loads of finals and been pretty shit, and then has like nailed it on a couple of occasions, and his whole career's, you know, changed, but you've seen that he's been through the trenches for the last 10 years doing it. You got Giles, who's like pivoted from a sole 800 meter runner to then going, actually, I'll give the 15 a go. So as like someone who's a bit younger than these guys and a lot younger in terms of running age and experience, it's quite good to see how they've all gone through slightly different routes and different ways to then how I can approach it. There's not kind of a set way of, okay, I must do this. Or if I've not burst onto the scene and just kind of made a team straight away, it doesn't mean that I never will, because that, you know, those guys have had to suffer and go through it as well. So yeah, for me, it's good. They're all a bit older. Hopefully, you know, good on them. They keep going. But as you get closer to something like LA, I'm sure they'll be making decisions of, do I stick at the 15? Do I need to step up to the 5? You know, injuries, wheels, all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's not something that is too intimidating, to be fair. It's quite nice to be a bit of an underdog.
Yeah, because you're 25, is that correct?
Yeah, 25, but I've started running so late that, like, my agent always says to me, he's like, we treat you as if you're like an under 20, basically. He's like, when we pitch you to like a race, or like the expectations you should have of yourself in terms of development should be that you're still in, obviously before I got injured, you're still in that phase of like the rapid development before you then start to plateau and things get a little bit harder. Just because I started running so late.
So then, like, going forward, will it be much easier for you to get into races? We're having a chat on our weekly show this week about like how Diamond League fields are put together. Like, is that something that you'll have opportunities to do going forward? Don't see many athletes getting around Diamond Leagues.
Yes and no, because I think, again, you guys might know more about this than me, but I think when it comes to Diamond Leagues, world ranking is obviously one thing that matters, but then obviously what country you're from, they can't overload it with, they have to balance it out right across nations. So if you look at the amount of Brits, let's say I was still fully fit, let's say I've just run 353 mile, I'd still be ranked probably on season's best, maybe 5th or 6th in the UK right now. So if you take the top 5 guys ahead of me, you know, they're taking preference over what they want to do. And for some of them, like Kerr, he doesn't really need to race. He can be selective. He's got the Olympic time. He's the world champ, can do what he wants. But for the others, there's some that are still potentially chasing a time, or they need to show good form to get picked for the British team for European champs or whatever. So if they're trying to get into all the Diamond Leagues, then they get preference before it trickles down to people of my ability. So yeah, I definitely think it's harder on a Diamond League perspective, but from like a gold meet perspective, and like all the guys that are trying to run your 336s, your 333s to make championships from across Europe, it means that what traditionally might have been quite a small silver meet where you might get one good guy, suddenly you've got like 8 or 10 people that are all going to try and hammer a qualifying time. So I think the variety of meets that are going fast is far bigger than it previously used to be. But if you want that one big breakthrough race where you can jump from 335 down to 332, you know, you need to be on a start line of a Diamond League where you're going to have a wave light or a, you know, crazy Kenyan bloke who's just going to nail it for 1200, and you can get on the back of it.
Yeah, the Monaco track, that always seems like a good place to go to run fast.
Or London. Honestly, London's the most frustrating because that track's good. People fly there. You had Adam Spencer, didn't you, last year? Who
we did,
you,
yeah,
like,
correct.
He's yours, but, you know, Adam Spencer, he went down from 335 to 32 or 31 high or something, didn't he, last year in that one race? And that was like a last minute call up. So that's the dream scenario. It's like, okay, big race, your agent gets a call a few days before, right, we've got a last minute spot, and then your whole career changes because you're not 3 seconds off your PB. It's like pretty ideal.
And even the races are tiered down from the Diamond League. Like, it's still pretty hectic where, like, you'll be waiting on a phone call on a Wednesday to see if you're racing Saturday and on a quick flight to another country, stuff like that.
For someone of my level, yeah, I'd say so. Unless it's a meet where my agent has particularly good relationships where they can say, right, okay, we want these two athletes to go in, and I can kind of get packaged up with maybe a better ability athlete, and it's like, right, these two guys from our agency are in, and then it's nailed. If not, then often it'll be a situation where if me and my coach decide, right, this weekend would be great to race a 1500, I'll have like an A, B and a C option, and I'll work as if I'm saying going to go to the A option, i.e. the gold meet, but I'll know that, okay, if at the last minute I can't get into that, or if I'm on the waiting list, then we do have an option that's definitely, I'm definitely racing at the silver, or I'm definitely racing at the bronze. So I can still prepare in the exact same way. It might just be a case of like on the Thursday, the flight is to one place or it's to the other, but I'm still racing one distance on one weekend. So it's not too much of an issue. I guess, you know, it is if you're trying to chase a really fast time, but there's ways of making it work.
And your coach Nick is based in the US, so does that sometimes get complicated with time zones and, you know, late race announcements and things like that?
A little bit, yeah, but we're pretty flexible. So I have a bit of a weird coaching setup where since I signed with Hoka, we kind of developing a bit of like a UK team, if you will, where a guy called Andy Hobdell, who's a really esteemed coach in the UK, he's looking after some athletes who have all transitioned from different areas. We've had some guys that have come back from NCAA, so don't have a coach, so it's like obvious to go in. We've had a couple of guys that have transitioned from previous coaches. When I signed back in January, when I was out in Poch with the guys, mine was very much in the middle, where I said to Andy and Nick, I was like, look, I said, the trajectory I'm on, I'm absolutely not changing anything until I need to change it, because why would I do that, you know? And even little things like I have funding for physio in the UK, and like I've not used it until recently because I'm like, I'm not changing my physio. Like, I'm keeping my exact setup, I'm flying. Why would I, you know, just to save a bit of money, why would I change it? So I said to Nick and Andy, like, I'm going to continue to be coached by Nick, but let's almost do it in collaboration, because there's no point me training by myself. So if the group's got a session on a Tuesday, like, if I can do as much of that session as possible, we need to tweak some things with paces or reps or whatever, then let's do that. So I'm getting the benefit of training with a group, but also having a kind of bespoke element that I know works for me, in terms of, you know, Nick's coached me for a good couple of years and knows, you know, what kind of will work and what won't work. The injury now is a bit of a hard break in that, where when I come back, actually, it'll be far more flexible with deciding what's the best setup based on where the group's based. And if we're all kind of based together and it's a case of we're going to run and train together every day, then do I just transition fully and go, right, I'm going to give it a go. Andy's going to look after me, and kind of Nick will just make sure that nothing's, you know, going crazy. Or do I come back and decide, actually, you know, let's keep it going as it was, as if nothing happened. And to be honest, I've not made my mind up on that. Both of them kind of know that and are more than willing to work together. So what, as and when I'm back, run, walking and jogging, and then hopefully eventually doing some sessions, I'll kind of just assess the situation.
Yeah. And are you like a bit of a running nerd that you consume so much running content as well, that you're pretty independent when it comes to you, what kind of guidance and support you need from your coaches?
Yeah, I'd say I don't know if Nick would say I'm too independent, but he'd definitely say that he knows he can trust me.
Yeah.
And his line he always says is like, if you can't turn up to a workout or turn up to a race without me being there and do exactly what you need to do, then he's not done his job as a coach. And he's always said, I'm not just going to tell you what to do. I'm going to tell you why we're doing it. Ask me if you don't know stuff about how it should feel or what the effort should be. Like, ask me, because when you do it by yourself, I need you to know that if I've given you 16 fours and after 12, you're absolutely cooked, rather than put yourself in a hole for 2 weeks by pushing on and doing four just because I've written it down on paper, you're informed enough to say, actually, it's good to stop after 12, or I need to dial back this pace. And same with, you know, how threshold might feel on one day to the next and stuff like that. So he'll, you know, he'll tell you, like, he puts stuff down on paper knowing I'm going to edit it slightly. And because he knows that, he will either over or under exaggerate some things. So if he's put 3.5 mile cool down, he knows I'm only doing 2. The reason he didn't put 2 is because he knows if he puts 2, I'm doing 1, you know? Yeah. So like he's learned what I do and he'll play with it. But yeah, I'm pretty flexible and I quite enjoy having some like ownership over the training, and I'll suggest as many ideas to him of let's try this, or should we do this, or here's a session that we could emulate, as much as he'll say, absolutely not, that's wrong. Like, don't tell me that again. Like, we're doing this. And he'll be quite harsh with me as well.
Sounds like a really special relationship. Was he your college coach when you were in the States? Is that where the relationship started?
Yeah, so I was only in the States for a year. For the cross-country season, Nick didn't work at the college, and then he joined in the January, so I had him for the indoors. And that's literally where, obviously, as you know, indoors, like the most they do is 3K in America. So he was like, we're going to have to do a shorter distance. And at this point, I'm still nailed on that. I'm like a 10K runner. I've done this 10K on the track, and I think I'm like, you know, going to be like the next marathon guy. And that's where I ran some good middle distance races. I think that's where we got the bond of being like, I had absolutely no idea about middle distance or what I should be doing, that I just did everything he said and kind of was very much led by him. And obviously, because the trajectory's just gone on and on, I've been like, well, you know, I'm not going to not trust it. But yeah, we work quite well together because he's not fussed with anything to do with exposure, what races might be good to do, how I'm going to commercialize something. Like, he couldn't care less about that. He's very much just like, well, I'm going to tell you what's right from a performance perspective. And then I come with the other side of it. I'm like, well, actually, this race, if I won it, I know it's not ideal timing, but actually it would get me this, or it'd be good for this or whatever. And we kind of have a bit of we meet in the middle, which I think is why it works well.
Yeah. Okay. I've only got about 20 minutes left with you, but I've got some talking topics here. I don't know how long we'll spend, probably spend, you know, all the rest of the 20 minutes on the one topic, but we'll see how we go. What are some of the triggers for you in our sport? What are some things you don't like? If you could change, what would you be tweaking? That's probably the second part of it. If you're in charge of world athletics, what kind of changes are you making to the sport?
So does this have to be something that like actively annoys me, or just like things that I'm just like don't enjoy about the sport.
Either or. So, for example, I get actively annoyed. I've been seeing this trend lately when people, like, I'm probably like that sub elite, like maybe not even sub elite anymore. Like, I'm a dad who just runs now, maybe. But I get annoyed when people at my level do a fun run. They come 25th, they've had a shit run. And then they go, oh, but there was 25,000 people in the race, so I come 25th out of 25,000 people. And you're like, mate, half those people were dressed up as characters. There were mums pushing prams. Yeah. Like, you're really trying to go with that clickbait line. It's probably 50 people in that race actually, you know, do it as a sport and taking it serious. But that triggers me at the moment. That's the kind of example, yeah, I'm thinking.
Okay, I'm going to get a lot of hate for these things, right? But I think I've got a couple.
You're talking to an audience that loves running, though. Like, these are your fans.
Yeah, but some of them might love running so much that this might be them. So age group successes frustrate me. So this is more in like the triathlon world than just in the running world. But when people are still a good level of runner, so if you're, I get it if you're like much, much older, right? If you're in like the V60 category or like 60 to 65 category, I totally get it. Like, you are running at your age when no one else is. But what I see is a lot of, say, like 35-year-old guys who are still good enough to compete in the senior open category, who are like very, very good and will win a lot of races. And they're like, oh, I'm first ranked 35-year-old in the UK, or like in the 35 to 40 category, I finished in this position or whatever. And it's just like, well, come on. Like, why? You were 34 yesterday, you're 35 today. Why has your whole goals just changed? And now you're suddenly like banging on about how you're in the veterans ranking. So that's part of it. But then the second part is, and they mainly do this in the UK with triathlon, is they have like age group, like GB vests.
Oh, yeah. This is an Australian thing as well. Yeah, so you represent Australia.
I'm like GB athlete. I'm like, you're not a GB athlete. Like, I'm sorry for being defensive, but you've paid to get the kit to do one of 25 races in the year that you can do wearing GB age 35 to 39 duathlon kit or something. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, one of those things just annoys me, because I think like, come on, like, work hard and earn the real deal, or just be like, you know, look after it for what it is. So something like that would frustrate me a little bit. But again, good on the people for doing it and getting out there. The other thing I think would be, how do I phrase this one? Like, what's the right word? Basically, like, all the gear, no idea, if you know what I mean. I don't know how to express that, because it's rich coming from me, because I have loads of kit and like I'm big into buying super shoes and doing whatever. But I think it can go way too far. And I think now for most people it is going too far, where people, I'm seeing them do like a flat lay where they're packing their bag the night before, and it's like they need to put more shit in there just to make the video longer. Because there's things that, like, I'd like to think I've been in most race situations where it'd be like a horrifically muddy cross country or like a really warm race or whatever, and I know there's only certain things you need, and people packing like as if they're going away for like 3 weeks survival thing, the amount of shit that's in the bag. And it's like, just because it needs filling up so they can take the backpack with them. So again, that might be a really petty thing, but that's my other thing of like all these little gizmos and gadgets and things that people have got that are totally unnecessary. Yeah, that would be mine.
All right. So you're Sebco, you're in charge of the big show, World Athletics. What kind of like edits you're making? What kind of changes? Do you want to make the sport more appealing in any ways? You got any ideas in your head there?
Yeah, potentially. I think outside of championships, I think more experimental races are required. So it shouldn't always be the traditional races. So like, you guys used to have like the Nitro Games, didn't you? I think it was called, yeah, where it was like the elimination mile or the mixed blah, yep, blah, blah. Or
big teams comp. 4x200. Usain Bolt coming, yeah, out.
Exactly. So I think I totally get how we need, like, in championships, I actually quite like the history of the event, keep it all, you know, pretty as it is. But I think way more experimental and like good things can happen where you're competing in a team with people that you're not in the same nation as. So actually, the way that sprinting is right now, imagine if Fred Kerley could pick his 4x100 team that he wanted, and then he's got a big rivalry against, you know, some other geese, Noah Lyles, who's got a 4x100 team. And it's kind of, you can imagine the banter that would go on and how it would kind of feud and stuff like that, get some more brands involved. So yeah, I think more experimental races and events would be my like key thing. And they're trying it, but like with shit events, like this 1 mile steeple the other day. Like, I totally get that? How they're...
1 mile steeple? Like,
Yeah, 1 mile steeper is what they're trying. And like, I know it's easy for me to say because I'd have to handle all the logistics and everything of it. But it's like, of all the things to try and all the things you could do out there with the personalities that are in the sport, why is 1 mile steeper at the top of our list to try?
Yeah.
Why is it not with things that we know we've got good brand ambassadors for, like the 100 or the 15 or the 5K, you know, like 1 mile steeple. But who knows? Maybe we'll reference this podcast in 10 years when it's like, you know, the Diamond League Premier event, the 1 mile steeple, and I'll be the joke.
Cut up the soundbite. We'll be right. Hey, you're also a content creator, I suppose, in the running space. I'm not sure if you like the term content creator or what you call yourself, but you're very active on Instagram. I think you've got like 25,000 followers, something like that. YouTube, you'd make like mini documentaries about your races, and it's very high quality, the content you kind of create there. I think you do employ someone to like do the videography and stuff for you. I guess the question is, and feel free to explain how you do that better than I just have, but do you think that is necessary for everyone now in the sport, that they have to have their own avenue to personally create their own content in some way to build their audience? Like, we see some people like Stewie McSwain's perfect example in Australia, very low key, hardly hear from him, rare to see an Instagram story, but he's our best runner by far. And then we see other people that do a shitload of content creation, and they're probably, you know, they're just, well, they've got massive followings, but they're probably, you know, 3 hours, 25 minute marathoners, but are very active in that space.
Yeah, I think there's a fine line. And I think if you class yourself as an elite athlete or that's your aspiration, you have to always make sure the performance backs up whatever else you're doing. And I've been very, whether it be skill or fortune, that when I started creating content, my performances also got better and better. So you were tuning into an episode and it wasn't like, oh, I wonder if he's talked a big game this week and he's run shit again, which is like 90% of creators out there that are like, Project 220, Project Sub 3, whatever, and then they just don't do any training.
Don't get me started on the 221. The 221 is the easiest one to that's your, yeah, that's your clickbait headline. And I've only just broken 220 twice, and I know how hard it is, so it triggers me big time when I say I'm breaking 220, and your PB is 228, you know how fucking hard it is to actually take those last 8 minutes off. Yeah, yeah.
So I think if the performances have to match, so like if people are tuning into your content and actually you're running really well, or it's obvious that you're not doing something that gets in the way of performance, then I think as an athlete, that's fine. So even with the content we create, like I do it with one of my best mates, Charlie, who's like, he does it full time now in terms of like he's freelance. So he works for brands and stuff like that. And I think people don't understand the relationship we've got where it's not like I just rang a video agency and said, hey, can you come and film me at a race, where they're in the hotel and it's making me nervous or there's pressure on, or they don't know what they can and can't film. Me and Charlie have been friends for so long and he understands running so well because he runs himself, that he knows like, okay, when I'm warming up and I'm nervous or I'm this attitude, like film from far away, or like, don't come up and say this a second before I'm going to race, or like nothing that we do gets in the way of performance. If anything, it actually enables performance because it gives us either the funds that we need to do better things, i.e. I can fly to Boston and do a race because I know I'm recouping some of the money from an advertised video, and or it gives me some level of extra, without being really like cliche about it, it gives me almost extra motivation to be like, this is going to be a class video if I smash this race. Like if I run this at the time, this is going to be really good. If I flop, it's kind of like a bit of a crap video, you know? So I think from that perspective, that's how we do it basically. And I think it would be a different story if I was running shit and still putting all this adverts out and doing all this sort of thing. I think, yeah, actually would be, it'd annoy people a lot. To answer your second question in terms of should people do it?
Well, do they have a responsibility to do it themselves now, do you think?
Yeah, yes and no. I think doing something, yes. Doing it the same as everyone is and having to make videos or reels or all that sort of thing, absolutely not. I think like Phil Sesserman, the British marathoner, is a great example of like, if you look at the content he puts out, yes, he does the occasional branded thing he needs to do for his sponsors, but it's very valuable and quite high level like captions about his actual progress or his training that he's doing. So he'll provide a weekly recap of his training, breaking down what he's done Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, etc., with like, this is why I did it, or these are the paces that I did. That's pretty simple for him to put together because it's physically just a diary of what he's done and a little blurb about how he felt or what his goal is coming up. And it's with one static image of him on the track that one person can just take. It's not some crazy content creation. It's literally just going, okay, I'm Phil, I'm doing marathon training to try and go to the Olympics. This is pretty unique that other people don't don't know and it will actually add value to other people, let me put it up in a little Instagram post once a week. Great. I suddenly now have an audience because people like me and you that are thinking, I'd bloody love to run a 208 marathon. I wonder how he does it. We're going to follow just so we can keep a tab on it and maybe apply some of the training to ourselves or that sort of thing. So most runners have the ability to do something like that because what you're doing is unique. Whether you're a pro athlete like him doing all that training and it's 120 miles or whether you're doing 50 miles, you've got two kids and a full-time job, and it's how you fit it around your work and how you make things, you know, how you do that. That is still very unique to you compared to other people. So if you're going to create something, it has to be based on your own experience that just you have, not, oh, everyone is making a reel of them putting their shoes on and then rocking back on the heel to show how squidgy the foam is. So I'll do that this weekend. It's like, well, like, millions of people are doing that every weekend on Instagram. So you're not going to stand out. It serves you no purpose really, you know?
I was literally in a Lululemon ad doing that in their shoes about 3 weeks ago. So and the agency asked me to do that. Like, this is, but I, so behind the scenes, you rock up and they've employed an agency to do this video and they're telling me that this is the trend. Hold the phone up here while you're running. We want to do, and I'm just like,
that's so funny.
And it's just like, they're very much like, these are the trends we see in the running space. And I kind of say, you know, running space in inverted commas, because it's different to the running space I would see myself in, but it's like, this is what we know. And it got 1.1 million views. It was like, this is what the market we want to hit. And for me, I'm like, shit, I'm usually out in a dirt road in the middle of the bush, don't have my phone in the hand. Like, it's not really the space I'm in, but you're right. It was every one of those cues. It was like, they wanted to hit all of that. And they were even saying like, it's got to be a 40-second reel because we know people lose an attention. Like, what if they're minutes? Like, you got to cut it to 40 seconds now because people just keep scrolling.
Yes, yeah, so what's unique about that is that, and again, this is where, like, literally this conversation, let's say that you're like, or aspiring runner, you don't know what content to make. This conversation in either written format or you speaking to the camera, that is like something that's super unique. It's like, oh, I'm in this, I've done this ad. Like, here's some things that, you know, I found out about, or the reason I did the ad was because, yeah, okay, it didn't completely align with my running, or like, I thought some of it was a bit cringe or a bit whatever, but actually it allowed me the finances to do this, or it supports me with the kit that allows me to do this, or the brand offers me this amount of exposure or whatever. I think that's what we need from more professional runners, to be like, actually explain why you're doing certain things. So don't just do your muscle food ad unboxing. Be like, actually, the reason I'm doing this is because, and just be honest about, like, I think all athletes want you to succeed and understand you have to make some money, you have to commercialize in order to better your own career. But for some reason, athletes feel a bit shy about openly admitting that. I think actually there's way more sincerity to go, you know what, guys, unless I win some seriously big races, I'm earning absolutely zilch from prize money, you know, and I'm an all right runner, so I get a bit of money from my brand. But I tell you what, it's not like, if you want to live in London, I'm not earning a banker's salary, I'm not earning loads of money. So I've got two choices. Either I can be like, you know, a bit above minimum wage and not do any of these ads and therefore not be able to travel to races and do all this stuff. Or I can show you guys some ads. I'll be really honest about why I'm doing them. I'll try and add as much value to you. I'll try and offer you some sort of discount. I'll do whatever. And you should just know that the money I'm earning from it is helping me do X, Y, Z in my career. I think if people were more open about that, everyone would be like, you know what, fair play. And now actually I want to buy into your ad. I hope you get another one. You know, I hope you work with more brands, because I see directly the correlation, rather than people seeing an ad and going, I bet he's making thousands off that. I can't believe he's trying to sell us that. You know, I bet. And it's like, that's not really the reality in the running space.
Yeah. And you're getting that opportunity as well. Because if you don't take that opportunity, somebody else might take it. And then you're sitting here whinging about, oh, why is these brands spending all this money on an influencer that isn't maybe embedded in the running space in a certain, and even having the opportunity to, like when we were talking about it, they're like, sent me some examples, you can film it yourself, or we can, you know, we're happy to pay a agency to do all the filming and all that kind of stuff and cut it all together, which you're like, oh, that's a good opportunity to not have to do that work yourself in a lane that you've got no idea about. So, yeah, it's fascinating. Hey, you do much reading? You got a book on your bedside table at the moment? I always ask my guests what they're reading at the moment. Nothing?
No, I haven't. I'm trying to think. The last thing I read was a book called Black Box Thinking. You heard of that?
No, I haven't. What's it about?
It's a great book. I'd massively recommend it. It's really good for coming to... The whole book basically is about how in different industries, some are better than others at learning from their mistakes and how they directly address failure. And as a result, their progression in the industry is far greater. So take the airline industry, hence why it's called Black Box Thinking. It's like every time there's a plane crash for the last however many decades, they analyze all the data from the black box inside the aircraft, and they can basically directly go, right, it was either a pilot error or it was this error. They can look at the data, find out what went wrong, assign the blame to something, and as a result, they learn from the blame next time. And that's why the airline industry's like progressed at such a rapid rate. And they compare it to things like the healthcare industry, where at least in Britain, the studies they give is to do with how when there's faults in surgery, there's such a hesitancy to give blame to anyone because of the sensitivity about it being someone's life that's been lost, that actually the rate of progress and trying to eliminate like the same mistake happening is actually at a far lower rate. And they do that with loads of different industries and show different things. But I think it's a really good book, and I think it's massively helped me when I've had a bad race or like something's not going well to be like, right, Callum, did you just fuck something up? Like, did you do something bad? Rather than thinking, was it windy? Did you do this? Shouldn't you have eaten this? What was wrong? And I'll just go, yeah, actually, I pussied out on the third lap and I ran 60 when I should have hammered it and run 58. Right, learn from it, move on. And like, it's helped me directly give the blame to stuff. So yeah, good book, would recommend it.
Yeah, that's good. Second last one. Who do you get your inspiration from? Got any posters on your walls? Athletes, musicians, any walk of life? Like, who are you kind of looking up to?
Yeah, interesting. Who do I get my inspiration from? I don't know. You know, I consume a lot of stuff. I think I get a lot from like entrepreneurs and like startup stuff. I love consuming that sort of content. Like, I love rewatching like really old stuff from like a Steve Jobs thing or an Elon Musk thing when he's starting like the business and how they speak about like stuff that doesn't yet exist, and they speak about it with such confidence. So I consume a lot of that content. I wouldn't say I've got like one like specific idol or anything like that. From a running perspective, it was always Mo Farah. Like, I think I just started running at the time where it was like, you know, I grew up when it was London 2012, and then as I was getting into running, Farah was like still class, and was the only only good British athlete pretty much in any of the distance events. We weren't dominating 1500s or anything like that at that time.
Him now in 2024?
I don't think I get inspiration from, to be fair, I wouldn't say like, oh, every day I wake up and like, oh, Mo Farah's inspiring me.
Sounds and prayers.
You know? But if you said to me like, oh, you have to chuck on like a race on YouTube now that's going to like get you pumped up for your race at the weekend, I would always go back to like watching Mo Farah kill someone over the final 400 or something like from like 2012 or 2016 or something like that. So yeah, from a running perspective.
We can cut this out, but I just finished Kara Goucher's book today. And obviously she goes into the Galen Rupp and Mo Farah and their rate of improvement. And for me, I remember watching those races, especially 2012 and the kick finishes. And there's an image of him when he come down here for the 2006 Com Games, when he used to be like Craig Mottram's like training bitch in a way. And there's just the image. He just looks like a different person, like how ripped he is. He's finishing kick like it's, and the stuff she talks about in the book. And obviously he's never tested positive. The Mo's doorbell, you know, Twitter account. Like, do you sit back and you just go, I'll look at this with a different view to the kind of fresh-faced guy when you're watching the Olympics in 2012, not knowing a lot about the sport?
100%. The more I've got into the sport, the more I start thinking that about everyone, honestly. And every old performance I look back, I'm like, you know, we had a thing in the UK the other day called Bannister Miles. It was like to celebrate the 70th anniversary of Roger Bannister. And they had like Elgar Rouge ringing the bell for the final lap. And like, when I go back and watch that world record, I'm like, surely not. Like, like everything is clouded in like in some sort of suspicion of what did. And there's the more you learn about the sport and the harder you realize it is yourself when you're trying to shave off half a second, you do think to yourself, like, how have people made this jump or done that? But I think for me, watching those races, I go back to like I watch it as if I'm watching it the first time almost. And it's the emotions of being like, wow, how amazing is that? Like, everyone thought the Kenyan or the Ethiopian guy was going to win, and then our little British guy wins it. Like I said, I get too emotional with stuff. I'm too attached to it. You know, I can't bring myself to look at the realities of the situation.
Yeah, well said. Hey, one question you wish I asked. We tried to go with your running and the content and a bit of everything, but is there something you want to bring up that I haven't got to with my list of notes here?
I don't know, you know.
What do our listeners need to know that I haven't brought up today about you?
You've been pretty comprehensive, to be fair. You've been pretty good. I think one thing about me, and I try and find a balance with this, like when I do podcasts and stuff, is that I just think there needs to be, I'm trying to be a straight talking person within the sport, and you can't burn too many bridges and piss too many people off, because actually, you know, it comes back to bite you and no one wants to work with you and you've only shot your own career in the foot. But I'm a massive advocate for actually removing a lot of the bullshit of people needing to say or do a certain thing. And, you know, you guys say pretty much what you want on the podcast within reason of like how you feel. And I think that's why listeners buy into the podcast, because that actually I'm not getting fed anything that's like a load of rubbish. They're actually just going to say what they think and say what they want about other people. So, you know, in the next 5-6 years, when all the press conferences start and we start doing running like it's UFC, then hopefully I get my time to be up there and do some trash talking.
You'd be a perfect character in that world, I think. Callum, it's been amazing spending an hour with you. Give us the, you're active on Strava when you're running, but give us the handles for Instagram and just your name on YouTube. Oh, no, Distance Project. Type that in anywhere, they find you.
The Distance Project on YouTube, yeah. Same on Instagram, but yeah, YouTube's the main one at the moment. We're trying to get 10,000 subscribers. We're quite close. So when's this come out? Pretty soon.
This is coming out this weekend. So yeah, so Saturday, Sunday.
There we go. So if you're listening, we need like 50 people. So you know, that's only a small percentage of the listeners. So
don't even watch his videos. Just click subscribe. Just get him over that 10,000.
Yeah. There you go.
Just need a Google account too, don't you? YouTube. They own Google on YouTube.
Pretty sure. Make it work. If you've got a Gmail, then you've got a YouTube account. There you go.
I do. Like, you could have easily shut that down and gone missing over the last, you know, 3 or 4 months, but the fact that you've been active but also promoting other people on there, like I think you did a little like mini series around Becky Briggs and her her London marathon, probably just goes, now listeners have just heard you talk for 65 minutes, but shows the kind of passion you've got for the sport, not just yourself.
Yeah, hopefully. And to be honest, the plan always was to try and make the channel not about me in the end. I just had to use myself because it was free. Like, I couldn't afford to go through an agent and give people a cut of this and do that. Like, it was easy for Charlie and me just to go to the races and start making the videos. But now we've got proof of concept. We're starting to try and do more with other athletes. So we got by the time this comes out, there'll be the second video of like a series we're doing about the new Hoka group in London, which I'm part of. They're building up to the night of the 10Ks, which is this Saturday as of recording. So yeah, we've got something with them. We've had something with Becky. And then we've got a couple other things that hopefully should be coming out in May and June, but all about other athletes, not really me. And then every month or so, do an occasional check-in with me just to see if my leg's still attached or if I can walk yet.
Yeah, that docu-series, I've just said, had a new Bob startup in Australia, North South. And it's just one of the most exciting, aspects of our sport where we're starting to do these mini documentaries. Like, I think a lot of people take an inspiration from Drive to Survive and thought, you know what, let's start sharing these stories. And I think people were afraid at the start and probably didn't have the video skills, but the video kind of world has come into the running world. And what you guys, the partnership you've got with your guy Charlie, sounds like a match made in heaven.
And what's mental is it, I'm sure you guys have experienced it through the podcast, but like it genuinely does. It's with no vanity that I say this, but it genuinely does convert to real people supporting you or the athletes that you feature during the race. So I know that this weekend at the 10,000, there'll be people that didn't know who Ellis and Rory and Scott that we've made the video about were, or they kind of heard of them but didn't understand them. But they've seen 20 minutes of their personalities, them having a laugh and joke, them playing on the Xbox, them going to training, them having a beer, whatever. And they will 100% now be shouting individually for the people saying, like, come on, Rory, come on, Scott, that they weren't doing. And it seems like a bit far-fetched or whatever, but if you scale that up, it is literally the equivalent of if British Athletics make a documentary about Keely Hodgkinson and then she races at London Diamond League, you've got 50,000 people in the stadium who are all now, okay, yeah, I understand who she is and what she's about, and I saw this bit of footage from her dad, and you're now really invested and you're making sure that you're like, when's the women's 800? 6 o'clock, great, like, let's get ready for it. I think it definitely converts to helping running in kind of a in-person situation as well.
Oh, and talking about emotions and stuff like you did before, I got a message after a race the other day that said, there's something like, couldn't be happier for a bloke I've never met. And you're just like, the fact that people send you that and they're bought into your story, and then it made me emotional reading it. I'm like, I've got no idea who this guy is, and it just made his day. And he was getting, it's this world that we're in with content creation and, giving people obviously what they want, that niche kind of market, and getting them on board with the journeys you're kind of doing.
Yeah, and just being honest about it, because like the only reason he's happy for you is because he's like feels like he's genuinely like connected to you. And I think the only way that happens is by you just being yourself and like giving your own opinions on stuff, opening up when something's bad, when something's good, having some humor, whatever it is. which I think is why you do have massive accounts that have hundreds of thousands of followers. But when they run a race, it's like loads of likes on their amazing picture, but there's no comments of being like, oh, I know that you worked really hard to get this because you did X. Or like, I remember when you said this on this podcast in February and now you've done it in June. Like, there's not the same longevity. It's just like a flash in the pan, like, oh, you know, that good looking person did a race on, you know, let's give it a like. There's no real connection. So yeah, keep it up, mate. It's good stuff.
Nah, beautiful, mate. You should give your boys on the podcast Run It Three Ways bi-weekly, aren't you? If you've heard Callum here for the first time, you can hear him fortnightly.
Yeah, Run It Three Ways podcast. It's a bit of a shambles, but we have a good laugh on it. So yeah, it's a nice outlet for our things that we can't talk about in our professional life, let's just say. So we just waffle for an hour. It's pretty good.
Three different personalities too, which is it's good to listen to.
You know, yeah, it's good. It's it's funny. Like, there's so little planning and preparation that goes into it, but I think because we all come from slightly different backgrounds, we always have something unique to talk about. So they come out every other week on Saturday mornings UK time.
Beautiful, mate. Thanks again for your time. I've had fun for the last 70 minutes and appreciate you giving up some time for the Inside Runner podcast.
All good, mate. All good. Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.